Another week. This is Andrew Wood, Executive Director of Hope Resource Center. Thank you so much for tuning in. You can learn more about Hope at investinghope.com. You can read our blog there. You can listen to the archive of this show as well. You can also find this show live, of course, Joy 620 every single week, or you can listen at iTunes wherever podcasts are found. So today we got a few things to cover. I was not in last week, and so there's some stories from last week that I do want to cover this week as we prepare for the 4th of July. So if you are listening in the United States of America, this is a big week for the country, and so we always celebrate, of course, our independence and freedom the 4th of July. There's some articles, and this is what we see every single year. There's some folks around the country that take this time to bash America, that take this time to say things like, I believe I saw in the New York Times earlier today in the Huffington Post that this people saying that this is the greatest country on the planet are inaccurate, and that this country is just kind of blah or meh, you know, not that good. Well, I would argue that to be so wrongheaded. This is the greatest country the planet has ever seen. And we do more for the world than any other place. And you can not just look at the freedom that we fought for ourselves, but the freedom that we provided for countless individuals around this planet. It's just something to behold. And so do we have our own black eyes and our own problems? Certainly we do, just like any other place, just like any place in the post-Genesis 3 world. There's some brokenness, certainly, but in terms of, is there a better place on the earth right now to live in 2019? No, there isn't. And so celebrate the 4th of July this week. Of course, this week is always big for me as well, because July 4th, we celebrate America. July 5th, I celebrate my pawpaw. My granddad was born on July 5th. And then July 6th, I celebrate my own birthday. And so this week is always special because you have America, my pawpaw, and then selfishly, I have my birthday as well. And so it's going to be a fun week and weekend, and looking forward to that. But some stories that I want to get to, there's some news out of London that was kind of hitting the rounds on social media and different areas last week that I think it's important that we touch on to talk about the overreaching of a government. And this time happening in London, but we watch things like this and we see that it could certainly happen in this country as well. And so we see different times when folks are going to the hospital or the state steps in or the federal government steps in and in my opinion, usurps power that isn't theirs, and takes away freedom from others. That's what we saw in London last week. So I want to go to that. So I'm reading from the Catholic News Agency, which they wrote a story about this. So a controversial UK court decision to force a disabled woman to have an abortion has been overturned on appeal. So that kind of gives you the context. What we had there in the UK was there was a disabled woman who was pregnant, and the government and the court decided she was not, she did not have the ability to say whether or not she would have her baby. And they were not going to just say, excuse me, ma'am, do you want an abortion? They were forcing this woman to have an abortion. She didn't want to have an abortion. Her family didn't want her to have an abortion. But the judge and the court stepped in and said, you will have this abortion. So in a decision reportedly reached June 24th, the English Court of Appeal, consisting of Lord Justice Macomb, Lady Justice King, and Lord Justice Peter Jackson, I'm assuming not Peter Jackson of Lord of the Rings director, but overturned the previous ruling of the Court of Protection. According to Press Association reports, the judges said they would issue a full explanation of their decision at a later date, but that the circumstances of the case were unique. A spokesperson for the Right to Life UK, Claire McCarthy, welcomed the decision in a statement released last week. This is a very welcome decision that will save the life of the unborn child and the mother from a forced late-term abortion and much undue distress. However, the horrific original ruling should never have happened. Unfortunately, we fear that this is not a one-off case, McCarthy said. We are calling on the Department of Health to urgently reveal how many women have been forced to have an abortion in the UK over the last 10 years, and make it clear how they will ensure it will not happen again. Mrs. Justice Nathalie Levin imposed the original decision on June 21st in the Court of Protection in England, which hears cases involving the legal and personal affairs of people judged to have diminished mental capacity. And so, again, to give context, we have a mentally disabled woman who is saying, I want to have my baby, and the court stepping in and saying, no, you can't have your baby. We're not going to place it for adoption. We are actually going to force you to have an abortion. And so the judge ruled that a forced abortion was in the, quote, best interest of the pregnant woman over the objections of the woman herself, her mother, and her social worker. So listen, the pregnant woman didn't want to have the abortion. Her mom didn't want her to have an abortion. Her social worker didn't want her to have an abortion. But the judge said, no, you are going to have the abortion. The woman, who has not been identified, is reportedly in her 20s and is of Nigerian descent. Both she and her mother are Catholic, and the court heard that they objected strongly to the abortion on religious grounds. The decision on appeal comes after thousands of people signed a petition urging UK Health and Social Care Secretary Matthew Hancock to intervene in the case. Two Catholic bishops in the UK had also spoken out against the decision. The online petition started by Right to Life UK has received over 75,000 signatures since it was posted. The petition urges the health secretary to intervene in this case so far as possible to prevent the gross injustice being inflicted by the state on this family and ensure this woman is not forced to have an abortion. Despite the petition, pro-life members of parliament acknowledged there was little chance of intervention. And they went on further. Doctors who cared for the woman argued that due to her mental capacities, either natural labor or a C-section delivery could damage her mental health. Her mother, described as a former midwife along with a social worker who helps care for the woman, both disagree and do not wish to terminate the pregnancy. The petition also drew attention to this particular judge's past advocacy for the abortion provider and her claim that Northern Ireland's abortion law is akin to torture. And so there we have it. We have a judge in this case. Thankfully, this was this decision was overturned, and this woman is not going to be forced to have an abortion. We are thankful for that. But what we have in this case is a case that should have never occurred in the first place. What right is it of a court to step in and tell someone they must have an abortion? Where do they have that right? And it wasn't like the family members were stepping in and saying, look, she's not ready for this. She isn't capable of even having a baby. No, it wasn't that at all. It was the family and her caregivers were stepping up and saying, it's going to be okay. We do not want her to have an abortion. But instead, you have a judge who it appears, after looking at some other cases, is not just a judge, but she's an advocate for abortion. And she's upset that Ireland seeks to outlaw abortions, and she's upset that folks are not for abortion. And so she takes it upon herself to step in this case and tell this woman, this free individual, you are going to have an abortion. And so I bring this up for a couple points. One being, this shows why it's important to fight, why it's important to bring attention to these cases, why it is important to sign petitions and to get involved and to speak out. Because if that hadn't have happened, if no one would have talked about this, this woman would have been forced to have an abortion. And I think it's also interesting that now the Right to Life folks are saying, look, we want to know more information. How many times has this happened where we weren't aware that it was happening? How many times has the court forced women to have abortions over the last 10 years? Because there's no way this is the first time. And if we look back over a 10-year period, is this a trend? Is this a judge becoming an advocate and pushing for abortion on these women? Is it geared more toward low income? Is it geared more toward those that they would deem are disabled or handicapped? Is it geared more toward minorities? Where's the trends in those decisions that were made? And I think it's important that we understand that. We saw just, I believe it was a year ago, with baby Ralphie in the UK, where the family wanted to get care for their child because the hospitals weren't able to provide that care in the UK. And the doctors at the hospital and the courts decided against the mom and dad and said, no, you can't take your child to America. No, you can't take your child to find and get a second or third opinion. And that baby died. There's a mom and a dad in the UK right now that watched their child die because they weren't allowed to go seek care elsewhere. Even though in that particular case, funds were raised, America stepped up and said, we will take care of you. We'll fly you over here. We'll have a doctor see you and see if there's any assistance we can provide to your child. This wasn't a couple that was dealing with mental challenges or mental health issues or anything like that. This was a mom and dad that loved their child and wanted to get the best care for their child. They wanted to fight for their child, but they were told by the courts and by the hospitals that they couldn't do that. You see, so when we watch these things occur somewhere else outside of our country, we pay attention to it because we want to make sure it doesn't happen in this country. It's the same reason why I live in the state of Tennessee, but I pay attention to what New York's doing. I live in the state of Tennessee, but I pay attention to what Illinois is doing in terms of abortion legislation. Why? Because, first off, I want to know what's going on in our society. Second, I want to make sure that those things don't happen in my state. We pay attention to these things because our tax dollars are paying, even though we have the Hyde Amendment, even though we have things in place that say our tax dollars do not go toward abortion, our tax dollars are certainly going to abortion organizations. Our tax dollars, even we're finding out some things even within our own state, and I'll have more information for you in the near future about possible legislation that's coming up that you need to be aware of. But there's all the time we're finding out these that there are things that are occurring at a state level, at a federal level, where our tax dollars are paying for things that we adamantly oppose when it comes to abortion and life. And so if we're not engaged, if we're not paying attention, then we don't know these things are happening. And I'm not saying that you need to spend all your time wrapped up in this stuff, but certainly we need to be aware of these things going on. We don't want our state to be a destination state for abortion. We want it to be a sanctuary for life. And so when we come back, we're going to look at some other things that are going on around the country and how we can step in and be involved and engaged in making sure life is celebrated. We'll be back. So today what I wanted to do was look at things that came out last week that I didn't get a chance to talk about that might have come out over the weekend, some articles and posts that I think is important. And one of those is the New York Times ran an opinion piece from John Irving. John Irving is a novelist and a screenwriter and is a, I would argue, not just a pro-choicer, but a pro-abortion advocate. And so he wrote something. I've seen a lot of arguments against the pro-life position. I've seen a lot of arguments in favor of a pro-choice position or what they would call reproductive rights or however you want to label it. I've seen a lot of arguments on those issues, and I've read a lot about these issues. And some of them, even though I disagree with them, I can read them and go, look, that's sincere. I see the point that they're trying to make. I may disagree with them, but I see the point they're making. This particular opinion piece is one of the worst arguments I've ever heard in why someone should be pro-choice, why abortion should be okay. It's nonsensical, and I cannot believe an organization like the New York Times ran the piece to begin with, but I do think it's important that we read through it because what I found over the weekend was this was written, and then you had the new president of Planned Parenthood tweeting about it. You had NARAL tweeting about it. You had all these abortion advocates tweeting this story out, this opinion piece out, as because they agree with it. And so it would be different if they all came out and said, look, we don't agree with the pro-life stance, but this is a nonsensical piece and we can't get behind that. But instead, they all get behind it. And so in essence, they're saying we not only are okay with this article, we support it, and he spoke for us. So I want to go through the article for you today. So again, it's in the New York Times, and it's entitled The Long, Cruel History of the Anti-Abortion Crusade. And so as I'm reading it, I'm going to make some points and of course, give some rebuttals, because I think that needs to happen as well. So let's start with the first line. Amid the anti-abortion measures being pushed through the state legislatures, consider the mazy history of abortion in the U.S. Women capable of determining and managing their reproductive rights have been undermined by men in power before. Now again, in the first paragraph, immediately it starts attacking men, even though it refuses to admit that in 1973, Roe v. Wade was given to us by men. White men own the courts, but he didn't want to mention that. So prior to the 1840s, abortion was widespread and not illegal in our country. In the time of the Puritans, America's deeply religious founding fathers, abortion was allowed until the fetus was quote-unquote quick. When the woman could feel the fetus move, that's what that means. So what he's saying is back in the 1840s, Puritans even allowed abortion until the woman felt the fetus move. Now, I wonder why that was the case. Probably. Now, this might be a stretch, but guess what? In the 1840s, we didn't have a lot of technology. They weren't ultrasound. There weren't any ultrasound machines taking care of folks that when they got pregnant. And it's an interesting argument to make that, hey, because something was okay back in the 1840s, it should be okay in 2019. I mean, there's other things that were going on in the 1840s that we certainly would oppose today, but I digress. He goes further. Before modern diagnostic ultrasound, abortion was permissible beyond the first trimester, up to 4 or 5 months. Well, yeah, because there wasn't an ultrasound. Our founding fathers got this right, he says. The choice to have an abortion or a child belonged to the woman. Beginning in the 1840s and continuing over decades, abortion was outlawed state by state, becoming illegal everywhere in the U.S. by 1900, until 1973, when the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision held that a woman had a constitutional right to an abortion. For more than two centuries after the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock, abortion was largely permitted. Why was it prohibited for almost a century? In the 1830s, women having babies at lying in hospitals ran a far greater risk of dying from sepsis than women having babies at home. With the help of midwives, women had been having babies and abortions at home since colonial times. Had midwives been as busy performing abortions as delivering babies? Beginning in the 1840s, doctors sought to gain control of the reproduction business. Doctors were establishing their new profession. Midwives were their competition. But why did doctors lobby for abortion to be illegal? What was their logic? Did doctors underestimate how great the need for abortion was? We know that the doctor wanted and they achieved it. They became the arbiters of women's reproductive health care. We don't know the doctor's reason for making abortion illegal. In the 1840s, the fetus wasn't yet sacred. Fetal life was still defined by quickening. When the woman felt the fetus move, not before the fourth or fifth month. From the 1840s to 1900, we know the results of what the doctors did, not their thoughts. Again, so he's making the case. Listen to this. He's making the case that, hey, it was okay before the 1840s. Why the change? Why the change? He even admits, look, there wasn't ultrasound machines back then. He even says the fetus wasn't sacred. They didn't consider it a life back then. So why the change? And then he goes further. One job of a society with a social conscience is to rescue its citizens who are trapped, who are painted into a corner. And then he says, I see my job as a fiction writer with social conscience as the opposite. As a storyteller, I look for the worst-case scenarios. My job is to trap my characters. This author wrote The Cider House Rules. It was his sixth novel in the early 80s. He purposely wrote a historical novel beginning in the 1920s when abortion was illegal, unsafe, and for the most part, unavailable. Maine was one of the first states to make abortion illegal. I put the orphanage I called St. Clouds in Maine. I purposely painted my protagonist, Homer Wells, into a corner. Homer is an orphan. His several adoptions don't work out. Homer keeps coming back to the orphanage. St. Clouds is the only home. Is his only home. Dr. Larch, the orphanage physician and abortionist, teaches Homer to be a doctor. In Dr. Larch's opinion, Homer is near perfect OBGYN procedures, but Homer doesn't want to perform abortions. He's an orphan. His mother let him live. And so the article goes on and on. And then that book became a movie, and it pushed the abortion agenda. And then he goes further. He says, I respect your personal reasons not to have an abortion. No one is forcing you to have one. Now listen to that sentence. The New York Times ran this at the same time the UK court was telling a woman, you must have an abortion. So that sentence again, I respect your personal reasons not to have an abortion. No one is forcing you to have one. Well, guess what? In the UK, they were forcing a woman to have one. And did we hear Planned Parenthood stand for that woman? Even though she didn't want an abortion, did we hear pro-choicers come out and stand for that woman? Or did we hear crickets? This author says, I'm pro-choice, often called pro-abortion by the anti-abortion crusaders, although no one is pro-abortion. That's his argument. He says, no one is pro-abortion. He says, what's unequal about the argument is the choice. The difference between pro-life and pro-choice is the choice. Pro-life proponents have no qualms about forcing women to go through childbirth. They give women no choice. Well, that's not true either. Some people would argue, and I think rightly so, that the choice was made long before the pregnancy occurred, in most cases. But he continues to argue, before the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision in 1973, the opposition to abortion wasn't widely referred to as a right to life. The Pope used the right to life term in 1951 in his address to midwives on the nature of their profession. He said, every human being, even the child in the womb, has the right to life directly from God and not from his parents, not from any society or human authority. The Pope told the midwives. And so this is his argument. And then he goes on further and he calls us pro-life zealots and the religious right and that we don't care about women. But here's the thing, folks. Here's the thing. First off, if you take the time to write an article like that, you're not just pro-choice. You're not. I mean, he wrote a book that became a movie that won an Oscar with the sole purpose of pushing the abortion agenda. And then he's going to argue that he's not pro-abortion. He's simply pro-choice. But did he write an article standing and fighting for that woman in the UK that was being forced to have an abortion? Well, no, of course he didn't. And so there's folks that don't really understand the pro-life, pro-choice dynamic and the argument back and forth, but it comes down to, is it a life? We believe it is a life, and science has proven that it is a life. The reason that it was allowed back in the 1830s, guess what? It's because they didn't have the technology and the research and the things that we have today. It's the same reason they didn't have an iPhone. The same reason they weren't driving cars, because they didn't have the technology we have today. We'll be back. So as we continue the conversation today, we end up with that. The last segment we talked about the opinion piece out of the New York Times, kind of wanting to take us back to the 1830s, 1840s, and trying, the author was trying to figure out how come it was okay then, but it's not okay now. Well, again, that's just nonsensical. I mean, there's better arguments that they could bring forward. Not, hey, it was okay in the 1830s, it should be okay in 2019. I mean, that's insane. And so that's when they start going to that place, and when their argument becomes it was okay in the 1830s, it should be okay today. When their argument becomes it was okay for the pilgrims, it should be okay today. When their argument actually says it was okay because they didn't have ultrasound machines, are you suggesting that we should take away the ultrasound machines? Are you suggesting that we should take away the education for our nurses and nurse practitioners and physicians? Are you suggesting that we take away the amazing facilities that we have, the nice exam tables? Are you suggesting that we take away all the research that has occurred? I mean, just a couple weeks ago, we saw that a child had a spine issue, and in Cleveland, they actually went inside the womb, performed surgery on the fetus, which is a baby, a living human being. It's not a blob of cells. Why would you perform surgery on a blob of cells? They performed surgery to correct a spine issue on a child in the womb, and the child is going to be just fine. Are you suggesting, is that author of that piece suggesting that we need to not do those things, and we need to go back to 1830s, 1840s, people having babies in cabins? You cannot make that suggestion and that argument with a straight face. But see, we're in an interesting place because those that make those type of arguments don't know what to do when not only as gospel people, we say it's life at conception. It's been life. It always has been life. And that's why we fight for the baby in the womb. But now what we're finding is science is showing us, hey, in California, a child survives at 8 ounces. 22 weeks and 3 days, a child was born, weighed 8 ounces, and is now cuddling with mom and dad at home on the couch 5 months later. Science is showing that we can perform surgery on a child inside the womb and correct a spine issue. We saw an MRI just the other day that showed maybe the best illustration we've ever seen and the best visual we've ever seen and been able to get through an MRI scan of a child in the womb. And you look at those images and you look at all the study and the research and you go, it's a life. It's clearer to more today than it's ever been. Look, the pilgrims, the Puritans back in the day, in the 1830s, now they knew that hey, after about 9 months, a baby's going to come. But they didn't have a clue what was going on inside the womb before that because they had no way of seeing. They based a lot of things on feelings, like what I feel this or I feel that or I don't feel this and I don't feel that. So thank God for the advancement that we have had in science and technology. But now the abortion industry, they don't know what to do because now people are starting to see, hey, that's a life, that's a child. Now my position may change a little bit. And we saw that in Missouri just over the last month as well. Missouri is in the process of possibly closing down the last Planned Parenthood in the state. Excuse me. And so a lot of folks are saying this is the state is targeting Planned Parenthood specifically, and they're making them jump through hoops that aren't right and all of these things. But when you dig deeper, when people decide to actually report on what's going on in Missouri, we learn that it's not just the state attacking, it's negligence by the Planned Parenthood in that area. So there's an article that I want to kind of walk through with you. A judge in St. Louis is deciding whether to issue an injunction allowing the last abortion facility in the state to remain open amid the state health department's refusal to renew its license due to concerns that include patient safety, failed surgical abortions, and failure to obtain informed consent. And while Planned Parenthood argues that the state is targeting abortion access, some former abortion clinic workers say the case is indicative of a larger problem that the organization has with meeting medical standards. The St. Louis Planned Parenthood filed a lawsuit last week and obtained a temporary restraining order Friday that permits it to continue to offer abortions despite the health department's refusal to renew the license. The Missouri Department of Health and Senior Services concerns include, quote, at least one incident in which patient safety was gravely compromised, failed surgical abortions, and concerns about quality control and communication with contracted pathology lab. The health department noted that the continued refusal of several physicians to cooperate in interviews regarding the DHS's ongoing complaint investigation obstructs the state's ability to verify that the facility is in compliance with all requirements of applicable statutes and regulations. So did you hear that? So the doctors that are providing the abortions are refusing to talk to the government about what's going on inside the doors of the abortion clinic. I wonder why that is. Missouri issued subpoenas in an effort to speak with seven doctors who had worked at the facility. Two staff doctors agreed to interviews with health officials, but others who are contractors or no longer work at the clinic refused interviews. Planned Parenthood responded that it could not, in good faith, ask the doctors to comply with the investigation, claiming the health department has continued to shift its interpretations of regulations that could leave doctors open to criminal penalties. Again, this isn't about the care for the patient. Now they're seeking to protect themselves. The organization also characterized the state's request to interview the facility's doctors as inappropriate interrogation bordering on harassment and asked the court to throw out the state subpoenas. St. Louis Circuit Judge Michael Stelzer, who granted Planned Parenthood a temporary restraining order last week, held a hearing on the case Tuesday and ruled that the doctors did not have to testify and requiring them to do so would constitute an undue burden. While the state's last abortion business insists that it's being unfairly targeted, former abortion worker turned pro-life advocate Abby Johnson highlighted public health violations by the Missouri facility on her Check My Clinic website. These included the repeated use of expired medication and IV fluids, staff using single dosable medication to save money, and a failure to properly sterilize instruments that are used from woman to woman. And then here's one story from a St. Louis worker. A former abortion worker who did administrative work for a few months at the health services of Planned Parenthood in St. Louis, involved in the case in 2016, spoke with a register about the center, asking to be referred to only by the initials DB. And then the worker said this, "I had a phone call that really sticks out in my mind. It was a young lady that was expecting, and she was looking for information for actually keeping her baby, and we had a folder, like a binder full of information, and all of the information was dated, and none of it was accurate. I told her to ask her OBGYN for resources at the hospital. I told her maybe check with the fire department or the police station and maybe visit churches in the area. My conversation with this young lady was overheard and my boss pulled me into the office and she asked me what I thought I was doing by giving out that information. I explained that the information in the binder was dated and that the young lady has specific questions about resources for her baby. Her response to me was, 'Don't ever do that again. We don't do that here.'" So the abortion clinic boss was saying, "We don't provide those resources here." And then this worker goes further. "It was maybe 2 or 3 days after I started and I was being trained by the girl that I was taking her position. I heard a strange noise and I was like, 'What was that noise?' It's like a humming sound. And she said, 'Today is procedure day. So we can actually hear the humming of the equipment coming up through the floor.' That's how I found out that they actually did abortion procedures at that clinic." And so that's where we are, where we have an organization, we have an abortion industry that they say, Planned Parenthood and others say, look, our main goal is women's reproductive rights. Abortion is just a mere 3% of what we do. Just a mere 3%. But yet when they are told, look, we're not going to give you tax dollars for abortion, what do? They get angry. They lobby against that. When they're told you're not meeting the requirements for this state to operate and you're actually putting women in danger, what do? They fight that. They file lawsuits and they tell their doctors not to talk to anyone. Did you watch any of the debates last week? Not one candidate that's running currently on the Democratic ticket, all 24, 25 of them, not one of them gave room for any restrictions on abortion. And every single one of them believed that abortion should be okay at any point during the pregnancy, should be on demand, and on top of all of that, they believe that tax dollars should pay for it. But again, they call me the extreme one for being pro-life. And so when we hear these stories, when we see what's going on in Missouri, when we see that Kentucky's getting close to getting all the abortion clinics out of their state, all these states are doing are requiring certain things from these clinics. They want to claim to be medical clinics. They want to claim to be operating above board. They want to claim to be caring about women. Then make sure you're meeting all the requirements. Make sure that the doctor that's coming to your building to provide that abortion has access to a hospital and privileges at a hospital. And so we have to, at some point, be willing to say, this is not okay. And again, folks on that side in the abortion industry, folks that claim to be pro-choice, should also want these women taken care of well and not put in dangerous situations. We'll be back. So as we finish up today, thank you again so much for listening. You can learn more about Hope at investinghope.com. You can listen to this show. Maybe you came in toward the tail end. You can listen to this show wherever podcasts are found on iTunes, Google Play, TuneIn app. I would encourage you to do so. So today we talked about a couple of things. One thing that occurred in the UK with, thankfully, a court decision being overturned and a woman that was going to be forced to have an abortion, and the court overturned that decision. And then we looked at a New York Times piece that I think was just nonsensical and it just shows the direction we're going in terms of dialogue and debate. And then what's going on in Missouri with the Planned Parenthood there and the last abortion clinic in the state. It looks like it's about to close, and we'll continue to follow that and update you on that as that happens. One thing I do want to point out, at Hope Resource Center, we're certainly grateful. We had a Grace Baptist Church brought us about 20 gift bags this week that we're going to be handing out at baby showers. I had a meeting with a pastor yesterday looking at helping us out with baby showers for the year. We had someone else from another church come in that said they're looking to help and how can they help and volunteer and those type things. And so a lot of folks, I've even had conversations this week with some old friends about the church and the local church and then the greater church, the capital C church. And there's some folks that are upset about the church. But I will tell you, and I can speak for what's going on here in Knoxville, is there's a lot of churches doing a lot of great work, a lot of pastors, a lot of staff, a lot of volunteers, a lot of folks that are doing gospel work, that care deeply about the gospel mission, that care deeply about seeing lives saved and lives transformed, that care deeply about the pro-life issue. And so we're grateful for that. That New York Times piece that I discussed a little bit earlier, one thing that guy pointed out was pro-lifers don't care about babies after they're born. All they care about is controlling women and forcing them to have babies. That could not be further from the truth. Clearly, that person has never spoken to anyone that claims to be pro-life. Clearly, that person hasn't visited a pregnancy center or a church. We care deeply about women. We're not forcing anybody to do anything. But if they choose life, we're going to be there for them. How many parenting classes is the abortion industry providing? They claim they're pro-choice. They're not pro-abortion, they're pro-choice. Okay, well, what happens when that person chooses life? How many parenting classes is the abortion industry providing to these women? How many baby showers is the abortion industry providing to these women? What type of mentoring is the abortion industry providing to these women? They're not empowering women. They say it's empowering to choose when you're going to have a baby. It's empowering to choose an abortion. They tell you, shout your abortion. Get your abortion laws off my body. Those are the things that they say. That's not empowering. Empowering women is saying you can do this. Empowering women is a baby daddy looking at his girlfriend, his wife, or somebody that he hasn't known that long and saying, not only can you do this, I'm going to be here and be a dad to this child. That empowers women. Empowering women is telling someone you can have your baby and your dreams. You don't have to dispose of one to get the other. That's empowering women. And so what we're seeing now in this country is we're seeing a push. We're seeing a lot of folks that are starting to see what's going on and starting to understand that pro-choice isn't merely pro-choice. That it is, in fact, in a lot of cases, for a lot of people, a pro-abortion ideology. And as I've said over the last few weeks, it is people trying to out-woke the other person. You think you're pro-choice? Well, let me show you. I'm going to shout my abortion. You think you're an abortion advocate? Well, I'm going to show you. I'm going to tell you which abortion was my favorite. You see, that's the direction that many of them are going. And for a lot of people, that is turning them off to the abortion industry and turning them toward a place of saying, look, that is not what I believe. We need restrictions. Women need to be protected. Babies need to be loved. Families need to be celebrated. You see, that's empowering. Empowering isn't taking away the rights of individuals. Empowering is saying we're going to walk alongside of you and help you in this journey that you're about to start. Which is why today we met with multiple people that are signing up for parenting class. That will eventually get a baby shower. And then after the baby shower, we don't just wash our hands of them. We have relationships with them. They come back, visit, send us pictures. Reach out during those tough days. Reach out during the good days. They know there's a place where they can find a shoulder that they can cry on. You see, those are the things that we're doing at Hope Resource Center. Those are the things that are occurring in thousands of pregnancy centers across this country. And those are the things that you, with your support and your partnership, allow us to do. Go to Investing Hope. Partner with us. We'll talk to you next time.
Lift your head, weary sinner. The river's just ahead. Down the path of forgiveness, salvation's waving.